Hello and welcome to the latest edition of ICTJ Forum, a podcast in which we discuss the latest transitional justice developments from around the world. In this edition, we will be discussing the situation in Kenya, where the Truth and Reconciliation Commission has asked for yet another delay in deliverance of its report. We will discuss the problems around genocide denial in the countries of former Yugoslavia and how that is impacting transitional justice processes. And briefly, we'll address the upcoming meeting on complementarity at Greentree and the apology issued to indigenous communities in Colombia by Colombian President Santos. Today with us, we have the president of International Center for Transitional Justice, David Tolbert. Welcome, David.
Hello, good to see you.
We have Suleiman Baldo, director of our Africa program. Welcome, Suleiman.
Thanks, Rafiq, for having me.
And we have Eduardo Gonzalez, director of our Truth and Memory program. Welcome, Eduardo.
Thank you, Rafiq.
We will start with Kenya. Last week, actually week before that, saw a very important development, a decision by a UK High Court in the case of three veterans of Mau Mau uprising from the 1950s who have suffered grave tortures by then colonial authorities in Kenya. The court has allowed for this case to be heard in terms of discussing damages that they are seeking for the abuses that they have suffered, and has accepted that despite the time that has passed and different objections that the Kenyan government should be actually addressed with these claims, has allowed for this case to be heard in the UK. The case itself has significant implications for dealing with the legacy of colonialism. But specifically in this case, Suleiman, I would like to ask you, what do you think will be the impact of this decision in Kenya itself?
This is going to be a significant event at the local level. One assumes that there are a number of other survivors of that episode, although it has been decades now. They will be in old age. Many of them have passed on already. And therefore, the acknowledgement of the suffering of those freedom fighters and the general community in this area affected by the conflict at the time in terms of forced displacement, villagization, and the rest is going to be an important development. With regard to divisions that occurred at the level of local communities, the decision might bring forward old grievances, old divisions that time has perhaps helped to heal, and we'll be watching out that the decision does not necessarily translate negatively in igniting some of the old grievances and divisions within the communities. From a humanitarian perspective, there is an immediate need of relief for survivors, given their old age, their state of health, and the fact that probably many wouldn't have many years to wait for prolonged legal sparring.
Leading from this discussion, we need to also, I think, address a broader issue in Kenya when it comes to truth-seeking initiatives. I would say, although the Mau Mau case is very much focused on the compensation, on the reparations, on damages to the victims of torture in the case, in Kenya we are dealing with a number of different issues, and I would say most importantly, the post-election violence from 2008 and the Truth Reconciliation Commission that was established to deal with this, to address this, and to come up with a report that would illuminate the events that have resulted in a number of victims both killed and displaced and so on. However, we are seeing this process now in a sort of trouble. We have had yet another request from the Truth and Reconciliation Commission to delay the issuance of their report to May of 2013. Many in Kenya are seeing this as part of some sort of political deal to stop the report being issued before the elections in 2013. Eduardo, would you say that this request for postponement of the report in Kenya is legitimate from our perspective? How do we see this development?
Before we go into that subject that you mentioned, Refik, I think it's interesting to add regarding the Mau Mau case that this kind of decision is going to raise levels of attention in other countries that have suffered post-colonial violence at the hands of former colonial powers. The rebellion of the Mau Mau in Kenya was not the only case of an armed insurrection in the context of independence. I mean, you just need to think of Algeria, for example, which seared the conscience of the West about the impacts of colonialism. You can think of Angola, former Portuguese colony, which also suffered tremendous wars. And these are conflicts that in many cases also engendered new conflicts in those societies. So I think the possibility of Britain acknowledging that these former fighters have a case is very significant, and it should be looked with attentiveness in many other cases around the world. On the question that you posed regarding the Truth Commission of Kenya, we should look back a little bit and make a little bit of history regarding what has happened in Kenya. Some of us remember that right after the fall of the regime of Daniel Arap Moi, a truth commission was proposed. And that was an exercise that regrettably led nowhere because the politicians simply lost interest in the subject. And I think that was an enormous missed opportunity. If Kenya had embraced the possibility of looking into its past, as soon as the transition started, many issues, many problems could have been probably avoided in the future. And then you had a situation such as the post-electoral violence, and the Truth Commission re-emerged as an option. And I think we have to be very critical, regrettably, about that exercise, because this Truth Commission emerged with enormous support, both in Kenya and in the international community. I think that the international community brought to Kenya lessons learned from the practice of several truth commissions around the world. The mandate of the Truth Commission was very carefully discussed, and the process of nomination of the members of the commission was also an issue of wide national interest. So what happened? We need to discuss this carefully, but the fact is that the history of this Truth Commission is a history, regrettably, of missed opportunities and disappointment. And I think the Kenyan civil society will have to act regarding this missed opportunity. Right now, the commission, as you said, is asking for an extension of time. This is not the first time it happens. It already had a previous extension. And the reality seems to be that they genuinely needed to finalize their final report. But the problem is that this accumulation of extensions after extensions, delays after delays, simply has destroyed the confidence that the public had in the commission. So even if the commission extends its work to publish its final report, it is dubious that this final report is going to enjoy the credibility and the deserved visibility that the victim stories should be granted.
Sulman, are we talking about political interference here?
Well, there is a real suspicion in civil society circles, in the media, in the public, among victim groups, that the delay of 9 months or a year that the Truth Commission has requested from Parliament was driven by political manipulation. There are elections in Kenya that have been delayed now, occurring in March. The expectation is that publishing the report prior to the elections will help the public in Kenya determine the eligibility and the legitimacy of particular candidates who may or might not be named in this report, or the report might give indication of people who might not be eligible because of their involvement in the earlier episode of violence. However, ICTJ, among others, have been assisting the Truth Commission in addressing its operation, giving advice on the drafting and so on, and we are of the opinion that they really need no more than 3 and 4 months to finalize the report, and that any extension beyond this practical delay would mean that there have been an element of political calculation there, which is issuing the report after the elections.
And very briefly, how important is it that the report is published in a timely manner in view of the recent ethnic tensions that we are seeing in Kenya, which by many are a replication of what actually led to the violence in 2008?
This is the proof that as long as you do not address violence that occurred in the past, this will reinforce impunity. This will encourage politicians to continue exploiting ethnicity in countries where this is a key identity factor. And hence, in a political season of competitive elections, the easy solution for these leaders is just to fall back on the tribal mobilization, ethnic mobilization line. We have the result of increasing tensions and confrontations among communities. The Tana River recent clashes have seen the killings of hundreds, the displacement of 120,000 at least, and there are concerns that crimes against humanity might have occurred in the context of these conflicts. Therefore, delaying the report of the Truth Commission is going to leave the space free for politicians to continue resorting to ethnic mobilization and increasing the chances of violence in the country. Kenya has really to come to grip with this.
An area of the world where ethnic mobilization is a modus operandi now for 20 years is surely the Balkans. And it seems that despite many different transitional justice initiatives of various forms, we still have a very persistent, very strong inclination by politicians to basically use hate speech, to use denial of crimes that have taken place as this factor of mobilization. Just last week, we had yet again the president of Serbia, Tomislav Nikolic, ahead of his trip to the capital of European Union, repeat this, basically denying the facts established before the tribunal in The Hague about genocide in Srebrenica and saying that he will never accept that what happened in Srebrenica is a genocide, nor will any Serb that he is aware of. What does this mean? Is it important to address this in any way, David, when a politician denies facts established by a court in this manner? Or is this, like some claim, simply a matter of freedom of speech, freedom of political expression?
Well, Refik, this is the president of the country. This is just not any politician. It's the president of the country who has repeatedly denied genocide in Srebrenica. Genocide in Srebrenica has not just been established by the Yugoslavia Tribunal, it's also been accepted by the International Court of Justice. Now, Serbia is a candidate for EU membership. I say this is a pretty serious issue for the European Union to have a president of a country, of a candidate member, who denies the Srebrenica genocide. But what I think is even more troubling is that it is indicative of denial across the region. It's not simply in Serbia. It's not simply the radical party in Serbia. We are seeing systematic rhetoric coming out of the Republika Srpska, Prime Minister Dodik in particular. We are seeing the dismantling of the Bosnian State Court, which, in addition to the work at the Hague at the Yugoslavia Tribunal, I think is a very underreported and underappreciated effort by the international community and domestic lawyers and prosecutors and judges to establish the facts on the ground of what happened in a variety of cases, not just relating to war crimes, but also relating to corruption, which the deep linkages between corruption and other forms of criminality in Bosnia and the former Yugoslavia. This court has already seen the judges attacked, the anti-corruption chamber essentially taken apart. There's widespread denial of not just genocide, but of what's been judicially established. I think this is really troubling for the region as a whole. The EU has obviously made deep investments, and some of its steps have been very important. The linkage and the conditionality that it used to admit Croatia, for example, into the European Union. But I think that the European Union should be taking a step back at this point, having received the Peace Prize, and looking at seriously what's going on. So I do think that we have to recognize that one of the central issues, the flaws in what provides some of the opening here is Dayton itself. Dayton hasn't been revisited since it was negotiated, and the division of Bosnia into these two basically, at least one of them ethnically based entities, really has laid the groundwork for some of what we see now. There's really never been a truth-telling process. There have been some efforts, RAICOM and others, which I think admirable efforts, but have yet to come to fruition, to have a regional truth commission process. And I am very worried about what I hear in Bosnia in particular, but across the region as a whole. I think there has to be a real pushback by the international community and all of us involved to ensure that we don't start to begin to slip back. Today it's the president of Serbia, and tomorrow it's others in the regions, and you're starting to see rising voices and rising tensions as well.
Eduardo, you've actually just come back from Bosnia. One question that we have touched upon here that I think is worth exploring is this relationship between judicial truth, facts established in courts, and truth-seeking, and this effort of primarily civil society in the region on initiatives of establishing the truth and memorializing what has taken place. You've come with an interesting example where judicial truth, the facts, were actually used in support of denial of the rights of victims to remembrance. How do you see this playing out in Bosnia after what you have witnessed?
You have, in this case, a leadership that denies something that has been established by a court of law. But you have also other strategies of denial that are similarly pervasive and very damaging, I think. This other strategy that I witnessed in my recent trip to Bosnia was actually not to deny what a court of law affirmed, but actually to split hairs about what it means. So in the north of Bosnia, in the area of Prijedor, the survivors of the concentration camps that existed in that area, for example, used the term genocide for the experience that they suffered. They think that no other word could reflect the kind of atrocity and suffering that they had to go through. Now, the authorities of Republika Srpska in that area actually attempt to gag the victims and prohibit the use of the term genocide, because the different cases of the ICTY dealing with the situation of the concentration camps, in those different cases, the judges were not persuaded that the prosecution had proved genocide. Now, of course, that does not mean that what happened in those concentration camps were not atrocities. The ICTY found horrendous patterns of atrocity, even though it did not find genocide. So it's really troubling to see that a decision by a court of law will be used actually not to push for justice for the victims, but actually to repress the freedom of expression of the victims. And I think that is pretty troubling. And it's something that I hadn't seen before. A group of people that has links to perpetrators using an adverse decision to actually, in some sort of rhetorical judo, turn the decision against the victims and use the decision to repress and continue the stigmatization of the victims. This is pretty troubling, and I think it raises the question of the urgency of other forms of memorialization and truth-seeking on top of, not replacing, additionally to complementing the judicial fact-finding that has already taken place in the Western Balkans.
We have seen last week the revival of discussions on the national transitional justice strategy in Bosnia and Herzegovina, which is now sitting before the parliament for a number of months. The regional initiative, RAICOM, has also hit a snag, so to say, after a period of very intensive activities. And in both cases, the obstacle that they have hit is the political establishment. Do these initiatives by civil society have any chance of success with the political context that exists in the Balkans today? And what is the role of the European Union in this context?
Yeah, I just want to add one thing to that, that Eduardo said. And it's something that, in particularly in the Bosnian context, but you see in other contexts as well. In Priador, you had crimes against humanity established. Genocide is a crime against humanity. It's a categorical mistake to prioritize these crimes, that genocide is and can be said, if we're only guilty of a crime against humanity, oh, we're not guilty of genocide. Wait a second. This abuse of the language of the statutes and of the law really has to be pushed back on. This idea that there is some kind of hierarchy of crimes against humanity is something that really has to be pushed back on. And the crimes in Priador are as atrocious as anything that happened in the former Yugoslavia or any other place.
Eduardo? I think it's interesting for us in the human rights community to discuss further the question of this sort of politicization of the concept of genocide that appears so often around the world. It seems that at some point activists who are fighting a tyrannical government feel the need to denounce that they are the object of genocide, as if genocide was some sort of absolute prioritary crime, a crime on the top of the hierarchy of crimes. And that is not the case. Genocide is a horrific crime in the same scale as crimes against humanity, in the same scale as war crimes, in the same scale as aggression. Those are the international crimes that are of the most concern for the international community. The problem with this strategy of hurtling the word genocide in one direction or another is that it has the potential of hurting the interests of victims, and it has the potential of hurting the psyche of victims too. Because if victims find out that their case actually does not have the characteristics of what legally is considered genocide, they may consider that the violations they suffered are not as worthy. If governments or if perpetrators find out that they can be found guilty of some crime other than genocide, then they use that as some kind of banner of merit, saying, as in the case of Republika Srpska, oh, by the way, we did not commit genocide in this particular case, only crimes against humanity. I think that is terrible. The fact is that the internationally accepted definition of genocide is a very complicated definition. It's a definition that is very difficult to apply to many different cases that are horrific. And so we do have, I think, an obligation in the international community, among human rights practitioners, to discuss more critically this term and to help victims' organizations, civil society activists, to have a use that is more precise and at the same time a use that serves the interests of victims rather than just trying to get in the news cycle that really can have very complicated consequences.
Could I just add a point to that? The law is not going to change. The Genocide Convention has been around since 1948, and I have seen this for myself, victim communities, for example, in the Krajnik case, who was the president of the Republic of Srpska, the ICTY, he was charged on 27 counts, 27 convictions, 26 convictions, not found guilty of genocide, found guilty for extermination. For extermination is a crime against humanity, and the disappointment of the victim community because of the failure to get a conviction on genocide. So it's a very real feeling. I can remember being in front of a group of victims who expressed enormous disappointment. And it's this rhetoric regarding genocide as the crime of crimes. And I think you're right. As activists, as those concerned in the field, we need to do a great deal more education and pushback against this.
It is very clear that the key issue here is the issue of acknowledgement, that in absence of acknowledgement, this is what victims see as the hammer with which to break through this glass ceiling. Very briefly, We are organizing the third in the succession of meetings in Green Tree on complementarity at the end of October. David, can you tell us what is distinct about this meeting and what are the desired goals and outcomes of the gathering?
This will be the fourth in a series of meetings, the third one at Green Tree, to really look at the complementarity principle to support domestic investigations and prosecutions. What we're doing, I think, that's different in the past, rather than really working at policy buy-in and bringing development actors and rule of law practitioners together with international justice, criminal justice experts, is to really look at four situation countries in depth at very senior levels. So we have attorney generals or chief prosecutors coming from these countries to have a conversation about how they've been able to or not been able to have criminal accountability on the ground. And also, what do they need? So we think by drilling down, we'll be able to show this larger group how this process can work and how it doesn't work and how they need to be supported. So we're moving very much from the universal or from the general to the particular. And we're looking at four situations, the DRC, Colombia, Cote d'Ivoire, and Guatemala. Each of these countries are members of the International Criminal Court and therefore under the Rome Statute, which provides the complementarity principle, that is that the chief obligation for investigating and prosecuting serious crimes, the crimes we've been talking about earlier, rests with domestic jurisdictions. Some of those predate the ICC obligations, for example, in Guatemala, which the former president is being prosecuted for genocide. So we will have the Attorney General and to talk to her about how this is going, what kind of support is needed, and to get a much clearer understanding. The same with the other cases as well. All the countries in somewhat different situations. But I think this will help, first of all, increase the understanding a lot, galvanize support for these particular situations, and for the complementarity principle more generally.
And lastly, we have on October the 12th seen a remarkable move by the Colombia's president, Juan Manuel Santos, who has issued a formal apology to indigenous communities in the Amazon region for deaths and destruction caused by the rubber boom of the 1920s, and in his statement acknowledged what was by civil society groups, victims groups, referred to as genocide against indigenous communities there. Eduardo, what is the significance of this apology as Colombia embarks on a historic process of negotiations that might see the end of the conflict with FARC?
It is very significant, Refik. October the 12th is a very disputed and complicated date for historical memory in Latin America. In the case of Colombia, Peru, and other countries in South America that were the center of rubber exploitation in those years, rubber created empires in the Amazon jungle, boom cities that had the possibility of building opera houses, wonderful universities, to create a real bourgeoisie that was built on the backs of slave labor by indigenous communities and that resulted in the extermination of indigenous peoples in that area. So I think the step taken by President Santos is very significant. It is significant also because it's not just making excuses. What President Santos said was that Colombia accepted responsibility, which is important, I think. Apologies, however, being very symbolically important, need to be complemented by concrete facts. There have to be practical policies to strengthen indigenous communities, to respect the rights of indigenous communities, to control over their territories and their resources, for example, to keep their unique cultural identities within the country. And it is especially significant that this apology takes place this year because indigenous communities have continued to be victimized, and they have been victimized notably during the internal conflict between the government and different guerrilla groups. There are indigenous communities in Colombia that, in practice, have declared themselves neutral in that conflict because they don't want to be dragged into the confrontation. And so right now, I think is encouraging to see that Colombia is looking at this particular issue. We need to make sure that this is an issue that is discussed in Oslo and in Havana between the negotiators of the government and the guerrilla. The fate of indigenous communities, reparations to indigenous communities, truth-seeking regarding the violations they have suffered, and justice are definitely elements that need to be discussed and agreed on in these negotiations.
We will be sure to closely follow the negotiations. But for this edition of ICTJ Forum, this was all. I thank you all for participation. David, thank you for coming to be our guest.
Thank you.
Suleiman, we are sure to be talking about Kenya in the upcoming days. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Eduardo, I'm sure this is not the last time you'll be appearing in ICTJ Forum. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And to our listeners, we will see you in 1 month in the new edition of ICTJ Forum.